welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope you survived the cold well. Coming up in just a bit, Amanda Sayer of Dakota Medical Foundation joins us to look beyond a single day of giving, that's Giving Hearts Day, and she explores how nonprofit investment, collaboration, and data-driven leadership strengthen community health across our region. And we begin Main Street today with this Conversations on Healthcare. Is Parkinson's preventable? Neurologist Dr. Ray Dorsey challenges long-held assumptions, examining how environmental toxins may be driving the disease and what prevention could look like for patients and families in this conversation with Margaret Flintner and Mark Maselli.
Dr. Dorsey, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much, Mark and Margaret. Everyone calls me Ray.
Okay,
Ray, that's
good.
Great. Well, let's start with an overview for our audience of Parkinson's, which is the world's fastest growing neurodegenerative disease. It affects over 1 million Americans and is the 13th leading cause of death in our country. Dr. Dorsey, what have healthcare providers typically thought causes Parkinson's disease?
If you read the textbook, it says that Parkinson's disease and what I was taught in medical school, some function of aging, interactions between the gene and the environment, and maybe a word about pesticides. And I largely think what I've been told is wrong. I think the principal causes of Parkinson's disease have little to do with aging. If you put a mouse in the laboratory and let it age, it will never spontaneously develop Parkinson's disease. The only way that mouse will develop Parkinson's disease if you manipulate its genes or expose it to toxic chemicals. And only less than 15% of Americans and less than 15% of people worldwide carry a genetic cause, a genetic risk factor for the disease. So the principal causes of Parkinson's disease do not lie within us. They're not in our DNA. They're outside of us. They're in our environment. Chemicals in our food, chemicals in our water, and chemicals in our air.
Well, that takes us really, I think, to the heart of your work and our interest in talking today. You're basically saying point blank Parkinson's is preventable and that over 85% of patients with Parkinson's do not carry a genetic cause or risk factor. So preventable is a strong and, a hopeful word. Your confidence on this comes from your research, current evidence. Tell us more.
The confidence comes from a woman, Dr. Caroline Tanner, who, like me, is a Parkinson's specialist, but has a PhD in epidemiology. And she quietly, diligently has been telling us for 40 years that the principal causes of Parkinson's disease are not genetic, but are environmental. And she's done that through a twin study in 1999, when she looked at the rates of Parkinson's disease among identical twins and compared it to fraternal twins. If something's very strongly genetic, it will be much more common among identical twins than it will be shared than among fraternal twins. But she found no difference, suggesting that the principal causes of Parkinson's do not lie in our genes, but in our environment. And then she has identified industrial risk factors in China. She's shown that exposure to a weed killer called paraquat is associated with 150% increased risk of the disease among farmers. She showed that veterans who served at Camp Lejeune, which was contaminated with a dry cleaning or degreasing chemical called trichloroethylene, have a 70% increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. And she's been telling this for 40 years, and we just haven't been listening to her. And once I had the gift of a sabbatical in about 2018, I read much of her work, and I came away wondering why I hadn't been taught this and why I didn't know it. And now that I've read it all and, spoken to hundreds of people with Parkinson's and done our own research studies, I'm increasingly convinced that for the vast majority of us, Parkinson's disease.
Well, I want to pull the thread on the thought that it's chemical or environmental. You have a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association Network. In it, you write that if you live within 1 to 3 miles of a golf course, you're increase your risk to Parkinson's dramatically. Why did you reach this conclusion? How did you get there?
Yeah, so the credit goes to my colleagues, Dr. Brittany Krasnowski, a geographer who now works at the Atria Health and Research Institute with me, and Dr. Rodolfo Savica, a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And what they found was that individuals who live within a mile of a golf course, and golf courses can use up to 80 times as much pesticides per acre as farmland, the individuals who live within a mile of a golf course have a 126% increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. And they really focused on the water supply to these individuals. I get really concerned that people might be inhaling the pesticides that are sprayed on golf courses. But nonetheless, the research showed that people living within a mile of a golf course had more than a doubled risk of Parkinson's disease. And this just adds to the evidence that exposure to certain pesticides, including that sprayed on those sprayed on golf courses, those sprayed on corn and soybean fields across the country, are at high risk for developing the disease. It shouldn't be that much of a surprise, given that many pesticides are designed to kill or damage the nervous system of insects. And if you give someone a chemical that's damaging the nervous system of insects, it shouldn't be surprised that it might have untoward effects on the nervous system of us.
Is it the paraquat or is it a different chemical in the golf courses?
The golf courses, we didn't identify the specific chemicals. My understanding is that paraquat has been banned to use on golf courses, although that research looked back at people's exposure in 10 years before diagnosis. Two pesticides that are commonly used on golf courses are concerning. One is called 2,4-D. It's actually a component of Agent Orange, which separately has been linked to Parkinson's disease. And another is a pesticide called chlorpyrifos, widely sprayed on apple orchards and golf courses. The EPA, because of safety reasons, because it's been associated with the loss of 16 million IQ points among 26 million American children, banned it in 2021. But the manufacturer successfully sued to overturn that ban. It's allowed, again, depending on the state, to be sprayed on apple orchards and I think on golf courses as well.
Is there a disproportionate number of people with Parkinson's who are long-term golfers?
That has been studied to my knowledge. There are actually three studies that link green space workers, people, landscapers, people who work on golf courses to the disease. In our book, we tell the story of a young boy who lived next to the 13th hole of a golf course in Charlotte, North Carolina, growing up. As a young teenager, he worked on the squad repairing divots on the golf course. At age 17, his parents are telling him to sit up straight. He then develops a tremor in his left leg and is diagnosed with Parkinson's disease at age 23. I just think if you look and you listen and you observe and you think, you really come to the conclusion that indiscriminate use of pesticides, many of which are neurotoxins, are having profound impact on our brain health. And Parkinson's is just one example of diseases that is affecting individuals.
Well, it's one example, but it is such a high frequency disease at this point. And I wonder if you could share with us how the government has responded, particularly to the fact that we have this kind of large, very large cohort of people who were at Camp Lejeune, high numbers of cases. Are we taking advantage of the sad opportunity to look at longitudinal studies, to look at treatment options? We have kind of a natural ability to look at control groups, similar service people on different bases. What have we done with this really critical insight into that high incidence at Camp Lejeune to try and further prevention and also treatment and knowledge of the disorder?
Yeah, I mean, so if Parkinson's is largely a man-made disease, then humans can end it. And diseases are not permanent fixtures of human society. Diseases come and go. Infectious diseases largely didn't come until about 10,000 years ago when we had the agrarian revolution that brought humans in close contact to one another. And we now live in a world that's largely free of polio. We live in a world where yellow fever and smallpox, smallpox doesn't exist, yellow fever is really rare. Few people are dying of typhus. So diseases aren't permanent fixtures. If we change our environment, we can get rid of these diseases. In 2024, the EPA banned trichloroethylene and perchloroethylene, the chemicals that contaminated the marine base Camp Lejeune. If we do that and that ban goes through, parts of it appear to have been frozen in 2025. But if we put that ban through, future generations cheer because they're spared the indignities of Parkinson's disease. And trichloroethylene is known to cause cancer. So we prevent people from ever getting cancer. the EPA administrator, Lee Zeldin, tweeted out about a couple of weeks ago that the EPA is re-examining the authorization to use paraquat. Over 70 countries, including China, have banned this weed killer, but the weed killer is sprayed on farms throughout the United States and in increasing amounts. If the EPA indeed examines it and removes paraquat, we prevent future farmers, future people who simply live or work near where paraquat is sprayed, likely from ever developing these terrible conditions.
Well, I don't think they're
in our control.
Right. I don't think there's be a surprise that there's been pushback from the chemical industry. Spokespeople say there's been a rush to judgment and that some large studies don't really back up your contention. What's your response to their claim?
Well, trichloroethylene's been around since the 1920s. I think a century of causing cancer is long enough. I don't think we're rushing anywhere. Paraquat's been used in the United States, I think, since 1963. 60 years of a weed killer that the laboratory reproduces the features of Parkinson's disease, including tremor, that according to the reporting from The Guardian, a manufacturer of paraquat had exposed three different mammals, mice, rats, and rabbits, to paraquat and showed it reproduced the features of the disease, including tremor, shaking of the paw. They did these experiments in the 1960s, 30 years before academics had done the same experiments. I don't think we're rushing to judgment at all. I think we should be asking chemical companies, why haven't they long since introduced safer alternatives to prevent us from developing Parkinson's and cancer?
Well, Ray, let's move on to what happens after an individual receives a Parkinson's diagnosis. Your book talks about new treatments, ways to help people. Please take us through the approaches that are being used now.
Yeah, so if Parkinson's is due to chemicals in our environment, then perhaps the first thing that individuals who have the disease should do is stop getting exposed to these chemicals. So it's akin to a smoker who gets diagnosed with lung cancer, what's the first thing the doctor's going to tell him to do? Stop smoking. Stop. And indeed, if you stop smoking, your progression of lung cancer decreases. And I think for people who have been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, one of the first things they should be advised to do is stop getting exposed to chemicals in their food, water, and air that are likely contributing to the disease. So in the end of the book, on page 237, we give readers the Parkinson's 25 actions they can take in their everyday life to possibly slow the rate of progression of the disease. Wash your fruits and vegetables, even your organic ones, with water and perhaps a vegetable wash or a salt solution. Use an air purifier, add a water filter to your faucet at home. Check your well if you're drinking, if you get your water from a well. And these same things also might reduce the risk of ever developing the disease. So there are a bunch of action items that we give in the back of the book. People can jump to it. If they want the Reader's Digest version of the book, they can go to 237. Lots of pictures and very short descriptions of actions people can take in their everyday life to slow the disease or to get their children and grandchildren lives free of this terrible disease.
Dr. Dorsey, Ray, I think our audience would be interested in your journey to becoming a Parkinson's specialist. How did you find yourself attracted to this disease and the cause?
Both my parents are psychiatrists, so I like to say I rebelled and I became a neurologist. And then I had a wonderful grandmother, and I've always enjoyed caring for older individuals. And in residency during neurological training, I found that individuals with Parkinson's disease, it's really based on listening to them, observing them, and you could make them better. And then only later did I really find out what I think are the underlying causes of the disease. And I can't think of a greater duty, greater responsibility than a neurologist has than to create a world without that disease. You know, my predecessors have created a world largely free of polio. I was speaking to Dr. Justin MacArthur, who's the chair of neurology at Johns Hopkins, and he's been caring for people with neurological complications of HIV for the last 30 years. And he says he might be going out of business because the incidence of HIV, because we're preventing it and treating it effectively, is at its lowest level since 1990.
Right.
And neurological complications of the disease are increasingly rare. I think we can create a world without where Parkinson's disease is increasingly rare instead of increasingly common. I think we can do the same thing for ALS. I think we can do the same thing for Alzheimer's disease. I think we can do the same thing for autism. We should just not delay. We should prevent these brain diseases now, and we should prevent, we should slow the rate of progression for these individuals already affected today.
I'd like to just sort of to use as an example one thing from your list there to really convey to our listeners the sense of how broad these are. I think people actually have heard quite a bit about the golf course phenomena and the pesticides, but you have on your list even dry cleaning. Most of us sooner or later go to the dry cleaners. What do we do when we receive the clothes back from the dry cleaner that you think helps protect us?
Yeah, so who knew?
And not so, me.
This is what trichloroethylene looks like. It's got a whopping 6 atoms, 2 carbons in black, 1 hydrogen in white, 3 chlorine atoms in blue. It's got a cousin named perchloroethylene that's still widely used. That one report I saw says that 60 to 70% of dry cleaners in the United States still use perchloroethylene. In a twin study done by Dr. Tanner and her colleague, Dr. Sam Goldman, they found about a 500% increased risk for using Parkinson's among people who had exposure to these chemicals used in dry cleaning. So get a green dry cleaner, use a dry cleaner that does not use perchloroethylene called Perk. And then if you do use a dry cleaner and are using, getting exposed to perchloroethylene, take the bag off your dry cleaning and let it air out, perhaps in the garage, perhaps outside, because you don't want the dry clean clothes to be releasing the gas into your home, and then you're breathing it in your closet, in your bedroom, and the like. We're just paying a really, 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 really high price so our clothes don't shrink.
That would sort of, if I could just ask a quick follow-up question, it would sort of suggest that a appropriate group to study might be people who work in the dry cleaning industry. Have there been studies that really look at that occupational group?
Yeah, so there's, to my knowledge, one tiny study done in Denmark, and they looked at various occupation journalists, accountants, retail clerks, farmers, and the job occupation that they found that had the highest risk developing Parkinson's disease was female dry cleaning workers who had a 1,500%, like 15-fold increased risk of developing Parkinson's.
You know, we've been talking about the causes of Parkinson. Are there any solutions out there? I know we've had a lot of shows around CRISPR technology, and I'm wondering if you see anything on the horizon around gene editing or gene therapy. Is there any hope for patients?
Yeah, so there's lots of hopes. In chapters 8 and 9 of the book, my colleague and co-author, Dr. Michael Okun, takes us through what are the most promising treatments in the short term, next 5 years, midterm, 5 to 10 years, and long term. And that includes some gene editing. It includes gene-directed therapies for about 15% of people who carry a genetic risk factor. Some of these might also apply to environmental causes, because it looks like the environmental causes of Parkinson's in many ways replicate the biology of the genetic forms of the disease. We also look at antibodies that could prevent the spread of this misfolded protein that's present in Parkinson's, just like we have antibodies to clear out the misfolded protein in Alzheimer's disease. Similar approaches might work for individuals with Parkinson's disease. But I think in the United States, you know, and medical training is that we want to go from disease to treatment. And what our book is really trying to do is go from disease to cause. If you figure out what the cause of disease is, you can prevent people from ever getting it. We can't cure polio even today. There are no polio treatment centers in the United States. We just have a world without polio. Mm-hmm. And we've done the same thing for yellow fever. We've done the same thing for smallpox. There's no cure for smallpox. You just don't get smallpox. No cure for measles. You just don't get measles. And I think you can
get a vaccine on those. Is there a vaccine?
I'll give you another one. Cancer of the scrotum. So in the 1700s, young men in their 20s and 30s were appearing before Percival Pott, a British surgeon. And he was resecting these tumors on the scrotum of these young men, doing increasingly invasive surgeries. And whatever he did, the cancer came back and they would die. And he was wondering what was causing the cancer of the scrotum. And then he listened. He listened to all these young men. And it turned out when they were young boys, 5, 8, 10 years old, they had all worked as chimney sweeps in 18th century England. Think Charles Dickens. and they were using their small flexible bodies to clean out the chimneys. And you can imagine the chimneys filled with carcinogens, soot that was getting into the sac around their testes and causing cancer. He figured this out. Eventually, Britain bans the use of young boys as chimney sweeps. And today you have a better chance of getting struck by lightning than you do of getting cancer of the scrotum.
Well, Ray, I understand you've reviewed the Make America Healthy Again plan from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and you've noted that you see some signs of optimism. Is that right? Comment on that?
There are two reports that I'm aware of. It's a diagnostic report, you know, identified pesticides as a contributor to the rise of chronic conditions among children. I found in the course of writing this book that we routinely spread pesticides, many of which are nerve toxins, on kids' schools and playgrounds, and we wonder why 1 in 31 American children have autism. I think we could the action plan could have gone a lot farther in terms of taking actions to ban these chemicals, to reduce their use, to find safer alternatives. So I think I think the MAHA movement, generally speaking, is right that there is something wrong about why 1 in 31 American children have autism, why Parkinson's is one of the world's fastest growing brain diseases, why 1 in 3 Americans who reach 85 will develop Alzheimer's disease. These are all unnatural consequences. These are not normal. These diseases, many of them, are being driven by chemicals in our food, water, and air. We get rid of these chemicals in our food, water, and air. We find safer alternatives. We use less. We create a world where these diseases are increasingly rare instead of increasingly common.
Well, let's continue the conversation about the federal government, because you're proposing that the government spend $3 billion to tackle environmental causes, booster research efforts, increase access to care, and invest in new treatment. Is that realistic when we're seeing so many federal budgets cuts?
So the federal government is spending $25 billion a year in Medicare alone to care for the 1 million Americans with Parkinson's disease. The cost of Medicare of Parkinson's disease in terms of incremental healthcare costs is $25,000 per person. If we prevent 1% of Parkinson's disease, we save Medicare $25 billion. That's Medicare alone. That's not counting the financial burden to families, caregiver support, out-of-pocket expenditures, loss of disability. The threats to the budget are because we're seeing the rise of preventable diseases. If we spend 1% of the money that we're spending on caring for people with Parkinson's on preventing the disease, we create a world where these diseases are increasingly rare instead of increasingly common. We reduce Medicare expenditures, and we let people live longer, healthier, more productive lives.
Have you had any conversations with the administration around this issue?
No, you know, I reached out to the EPA administrators, I think, for, you know, since about 2020, if not before then, and to many politicians. Listen, the two individuals who wrote the foreword to our book are Congressman Gus Bilirakis, whose brother died from Parkinson's disease, whose father has Parkinson's disease, Republican from Florida, and Congresswoman Jennifer Wexton, who developed a rare form of Parkinsonian disorder called PSP. And she was so disabled that she had to step down and not run for reelection in 2024. This is a nonpartisan issue. Parkinson's doesn't care if you're a Republican or Democrat, quite frankly, doesn't care if you're a capitalist or a communist. This disease is rising rapidly. It's rising in all parts of the United States, and it's rising throughout the world, especially in the areas of the world that are undergoing most rapid industrialization, like India and China. If we take action to prevent people from getting exposed to this disease, we create a world that is likely what 99.9% of human history, where Parkinson's disease was extraordinarily rare, only rare ancient descriptions of the disease. It's only in the first major description of Parkinson's disease wasn't until 200 years ago by Dr. Parkinson, who said the disease had not been classified in the medical literature. Mm-hmm. It, like lung cancer, is a new disease, and we can say goodbye to these diseases. We can say goodbye to lung cancer by stopping smoking. We can say goodbye to a lot of lung cancer by stopping smoking. We can say goodbye to much of Parkinson's disease by cleaning up our environment.
Well, Ray, sometimes when there's a very well-known figure from media, entertainment, politics, with the disease, it brings public attention to it. And I think we had a researcher from the Michael J. Fox Foundation on our show. And Michael himself, I understand, believes that his case was caused by chemical exposure. How do most patients react to your writing? Do you hear from patients saying, "Now I understand," or what's the response that you get when they hear about this?
So first of all, we should be, in the words of Michael J. Fox, Parkinson's disease sucks, and it's really hard to bear the burden, and it's really hard to be the face of disease. So we should thank people like Michael J. Fox, right, like Brian Grant, like Davis Finney, for their service, and for Michael, in the case of Michael J. Fox, for 30 years of being the face of disease, because he brings attention to it. He's reduced the burden of the disease for millions of people across the world, raised funds for research. So should we thank these public figures when they do come forward? My inbox is filled every day. I got an email this morning from connecting me to someone who was a first responder at 9/11, a firefighter who developed Parkinson's disease, and evidently has friends and colleagues who also have Parkinson's disease. We're doing a nationwide listening tour that's taken us to 25 cities and 15 states. I met a woman in South Dakota. Her job as a teenager was to raise a flag to tell the crop duster where to spray the pesticides on farms as a young girl. Met a man in Dallas, Texas, who had the same job. Met people in West Virginia who worked in chemical plant, but he worked in a white collar job. And then he told me later, after hearing me talk, that he loved to degrease cars and was likely using trichloroethylene as a teenager. You know, in the book, we talk about Brian Grant, who is a 3-year-old boy at the Marine Base Camp Lejeune when his father, a Marine, is stationed there. He's likely being exposed to these chemicals. I think one thing that we're learning is that, one, this resonates. People are giving, I think, answers to what causes their disease, which lets them take action to slow the rate of progression, lets them take action to prevent their kids and grandkids from getting the disease. And if we know what the cause of disease is, for those who want to cure Parkinson's disease, the prerequisite to a medical cure is knowing its cause. And if we know what its causes are, we can more readily and faster develop treatments for Parkinson's disease. Well, the other thing I'd like to emphasize is that I think that the seeds of these diseases are planted young. You don't develop lung cancer at age 60 because you started smoking cigarettes at 58. You develop lung cancer at 60 because you were likely smoking at age 20. I think in many people that we've been listening to, that the seeds of the disease are planted early, sometimes in your 20s when, like the Marines at Camp Lejeune, or sometimes when you're a young child, or even possible in your mother's womb.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dorsey, for joining us. Your book with co-author Dr. Michael Okun is The Parkinson's Plan. It's published by Public Affairs.
Thank you very much. If people have questions about Parkinson's disease, they can just email me at info@pdplan.org, info@pdplan.org. And the book is available for purchase on Amazon or in your library or wherever you like to get books.
That's wonderful. Thank you for taking
the time. Thank you so much, and thank you for your work.
Still to come on Main Street, Beyond Giving Hearts Day, philanthropy shapes community health. We'll learn more from the Dakota Medical Foundation. Stay with us. Main Street continues on this Monday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're talking about health, generosity, and the systems that quietly support our local communities when people need help the most. Joining us is Amanda Sayer. She's the director of Giving Hearts Day for the Dakota Medical Foundation. For more than half a century, Dakota Medical Foundation has worked to improve health and quality of life across North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, not by providing care directly, but by strengthening nonprofits, convening partners, and helping communities respond to real and often urgent needs. Many listeners know that DMF through Giving Hearts Day, but the foundation's work extends well beyond a single day of giving. Again, Amanda joins us to talk about how the foundation approaches community health, what needs they're seeing right now, and how philanthropy fits into the bigger picture of well-being in our region as Giving Hearts Day approaches. Amanda, welcome to Main Street.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We are pleased that you are with us, Amanda. Tell us, for listeners who may not know, what is the Dakota Medical Foundation?
So Dakota Medical Foundation is based here in Fargo, North Dakota, and our mission really is to improve the health and quality of life of those in our region. And, you know, one way that we do that is through Giving Hearts Day. We really believe that our nonprofits are in our region are really the ones creating change. They're, you know, the boots on the ground. They're making this a great place to live and raise our families. And so we really do invest in our nonprofits and the things that they're doing.
DMF has roots that go back more than 50 years. How has the foundation's role changed? And then community health challenges have evolved, and your work with Giving Hearts Day has too evolved.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we do try to keep tabs on trends and things that are happening in our region. You know, one thing that we're really focused on right now is the mental health crisis that's happening across not only our region, but really across the country. You know, young people feeling disconnected, adults feeling disconnected from each other. You know, that's something that we're really focused on right now. That's a great way to kind of bring Giving Hearts Day into it, because we really do feel like Giving Hearts Day is a great connector. It's an invitation to the community to reach out to nonprofits, to connect with them, you know, volunteer your time there, show up for them. And you know, when you find that connection, when you find that purpose, it really does, as an individual, bring back some more purpose and joy into your own life.
Giving Hearts Day has truly grown into one of the largest giving days in the country. And what do you think, Amanda, surprises people the most about how it works behind the scenes where you're directly involved?
You know, one thing that the community doesn't always see is that we are offering training and coaching to nonprofits year round. So, you know, Giving Hearts Day, we kind of consider to be the Super Bowl of giving. So it's a great way to take all the tools and resources that that we offer and kind of put it into play for Giving Hearts Day. But, you know, we're looking at nonprofits and wanting them to be healthy, not just for Giving Hearts Day, but year after year, growing their missions, expanding their vision. And we do that through coaching and training. So we talk about capacity building, and we talk about cultivating your donors and, you know, relationships, and how are you communicating with them? How are you keeping those people in your mission year round?
Beyond just the dollars raised, what do you feel Giving Hearts Day reveals about the communities that are directly impacted and participate?
I think that Giving Hearts Day is a great reminder that we live in an extremely generous community. You know, the dollar number does continue to go up year after year. And that is, you know, that's due to people in our neighborhoods that continue to step up year after year. And so I think it's a great reminder that you know, in a time that we could feel divided, this is a great way to come together and support our nonprofits and celebrate the hard work that they're doing.
How does Dakota Medical Foundation think about donor trust? And we hear the word transparency when you're coordinating an event that involves really hundreds of nonprofits and tens of thousands of donors.
You know, that's a great question. There is a lot of nonprofits that participate. We have an application process in the summer. So, you know, we do check in and make sure that nonprofits have their 501c3. And, you know, we ask a few questions to make sure that they're running in a responsible fashion. But I would also encourage anybody who is making a donation to a nonprofit, whether it's large or small, to really get to know that nonprofit and you know, understand what their mission is, you know, understand how, you know, the people that they're helping, and make sure that that aligns with your own, you know, kind of your own way that you would like to support that nonprofit.
Amanda, do you see certain issues that are kind of rising to the top across North Dakota? You mentioned mental health earlier, but certain issues that really need our support here in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota?
Yeah, mental health, again, yes, a big one. But, you know, also, you know, homelessness and making sure that people's basic needs are met, you know, is something that's on the rise as well. That's one of the reasons that we incorporated food and goods drives into the day as well. You know, from the donor perspective, we want people to participate in a way that feels good to them and in a way that they can, even if they can't give monetarily. Maybe, you know, you have some canned goods that you could donate, or some clothes that, you know, your kids have grown out of, something like that. But also from the other perspective is that, you know, we have our food pantries and that are you know, also in need right now. They have empty shelves. So just, again, inviting the community to participate in different ways, but also filling the needs that are out there in our community right now.
Amanda, can you speak of the program Lend a Hand Up for us just a moment, and how it addresses medical financial hardship, and why this kind of support, like all of the support is given, is still necessary in this case, even for folks who have insurance?
Yes, Lend a Hand Up is another program here at Dakota Medical Foundation. Really an incredible program. You know, we know that one of the leading causes of bankruptcy is because of medical bills and financial hardships that come when you have, you know, a medical crisis. So the Lend a Hand Up program is here to help when you do experience that medical crisis. They're here to help if you want to throw a benefit and give tools and resources to be able to do that. A lot of times that's kind of something that people aren't familiar with how to do. Also, the program offers matching funds to the family as well, so that the gifts that are given to that family pass right through that family, but then we also have additional boost funding as well.
Enjoying my conversation with Amanda Sayer. She's the Giving Hearts Director for the Dakota Medical Foundation, and we're talking about how the foundation approaches community health, what needs they're seeing now, and how philanthropy right here in our state fits into the bigger picture of well-being in the region. Amanda, the Dakota Medical Foundation often brings organizations together rather than having each individual organization kind of work in isolation. Tell me about that collaboration and why it's so critical, and why it not only benefits the individual organizations, but it benefits all of us addressing health challenges.
That is, if I would have had to pick another thing that the community doesn't always see, it is that collaboration part. You know, we try to bring charities together for trainings and different things like that, but we do have also regional collaboratives that are working together to help promote Giving Hearts Day within their community. And, you know, they're better at knowing their own community than we are, so we can support them in any way possible. You know, not only is that great for Giving Hearts Day and supporting the day, but it really creates a network between the nonprofits where they feel like they have, you know, a community of their own, a group where they can ask questions, bounce ideas off of each other. You know, I've seen nonprofits be so generous to each other, their advice to each other, how generous they are with helping them through ups and downs or celebrating wins with them, you know, collaborating together, different missions that mesh well together, you know, working together to do different fundraisers. So it's really an incredible network that's built behind the scenes.
Do you use research and data to kind of guide you, Amanda? Can you kind of pull the curtain back a little bit on how decisions are made using data instead of just kind of gut feelings?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that anyone's asked me that question before. You know, we do look at a lot of data behind the scenes. You know, we have a very large demographic of nonprofits, you know, from from large staff and lots of resources to small, you know, volunteer run nonprofits who are maybe new or, like I said, all volunteer run. So, you know, we definitely are looking at trends of giving across the state. You know, we compare giving to things like to voter numbers and saturation of people across the county. So we definitely are looking at different trends. You know, trying to take into account the different number of nonprofits we have, but then also what does giving look like across the state and across the country, really.
Are there areas you can share with us, Amanda, where you see really, really neat, exciting hope or momentum, places where communities really are making real progress because of the support of Giving Hearts Day?
One thing that I think is interesting is the charity's use of major gifts for Giving Hearts Day, and a major gift can mean something very different to every individual organization. Like I said, we have small, medium, large, you know, different organizations. So what they consider a major gift might be different. But the thing that is exciting to us is that it means that they're using Giving Hearts Day again to build on relationships and to start having conversations. And, you know, the longer you cultivate the donor, you know, the more support that you're able to get from that donor a lot of times. So I think that's always interesting, is seeing how they're leveraging Giving Hearts Day for, you know, for kind of long-term giving and how it really boosts them into their year.
Why is Giving Hearts Day in February? Is it just because Valentine's Day, or are there other reasons why February really works well for Giving Hearts Day?
Well, it's an interesting backstory. So Giving Hearts Day did start with the idea that if you didn't have a loved one to connect with on Valentine's Day, you could give to a nonprofit that you love. So that is kind of the core for all these years ago when Giving Hearts Day started. And it's definitely grown and evolved since then. You know, we like to think that the nonprofits come off of year end. And that's a big lift for them. That's a busy time for them to close out their year. But then Giving Hearts Day a lot of times gives them, like I had said, that nice boost into their current year and helps them to plan, you know, what else they need to be doing to meet their mission for that year.
Give us an idea of the numbers of nonprofits that we're talking about here that you're working with to make this all so successful.
There's almost 650 nonprofits participating this year. So I can guarantee you that there is something for everybody, whether you're looking to give locally or you have a certain mission that you want to support. There's definitely a lot of nonprofits. Then they're all, you know, all across the state.
So let's consider a nonprofit who might be new, who's just getting off the ground. What should they do to develop a relationship with you and then cultivate the leverage that Dakota Medical Foundation provides?
You know, we do have a lot of new nonprofits. I think this year we have 44 that are new to Giving Hearts Day. So for a new nonprofit, we like to have a call with them over the summer and get to know them a little bit, understand, you know, what support they have. You know, do they have volunteers? Do they have board? How can we utilize this group of people to help you through your Giving Hearts Day campaign? And then we definitely encourage them to participate in the training. So we offer monthly trainings throughout the Giving Hearts Day season, help them walk them through their campaign, really help them build a foundation in their first year so that when they go into their next Giving Hearts Day, they have, you know, lessons learned. We have, you know, built maybe a committee or we've built a community. We have a donor base, and now we can just propel that into our next year.
There are listeners who are wondering, how can I participate? How can I help? Or even, I may not have a lot of money to give, but I really want to be a part of this work. What would you tell those folks?
Well, I would tell them to visit the website, Giving Hearts Day. You can actually give early if you're planning to give this year. So that's open right now. If you're worried about missing the day, you can just check that box right now. But other ways to participate. So if you, you know, can't give monetarily, but we definitely want you to feel like you're part of this movement and part of the community, you can find different ways to volunteer your time on the website. So you can find a nonprofit and connect with them through volunteerism. You know, I'm sure that there's lots of charities out there that still would like some help moving their campaign forward. You know, thank you notes, phone calls, different things like that. But then also, again, you can find different places to drop off goods as well. So there's a map on the website where you can find someplace locally that's taking in food or goods.
Amanda, do you allow faith-based organizations to participate in Giving Hearts Day? Is that also part of the mission?
Yep, we do. We have quite a few faith-based organizations.
And I guess my last question to you, what surprises people the most when you tell them that you're in charge of helping Giving Hearts Day be a success? What surprises folks?
You know, I would say that, you know, the staff here at Dakota Medical Foundation, we're pretty small and mighty, but it's really, you know, the nonprofits that are creating these big waves. Not only our nonprofits, but the businesses and the community that's rallied around Giving Hearts Day. You know, we see just a huge ripple effect of, you know, our businesses and nonprofits who are also, like, kind of banging the drum for Giving Hearts Day. They're, you know, using their advertising dollars and they're, you know, getting the message out there more than us in a lot of regions. And so I think that surprises people is how much the community is carrying the message of Giving Hearts Day.
Amanda, one more time, how can people get in contact with the Dakota Medical Foundation? And then how can people give on Giving Hearts Day?
I would tell everybody to go to the website Giving Hearts. There's contact information there if you have specific questions or would like to reach out to us about anything, but you can go there and you can make your donation today.
Amanda Sayer, she's the director of Giving Hearts Day for the Dakota Medical Foundation, and we've been talking to her about how philanthropy, collaboration, and community investment shape health and shaped success for many nonprofits across North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. You can learn more about the Dakota Medical Foundation, its initiatives, and ways to get involved at givingheartsday.com, as Amanda noted, and also DACMED, DAKMED.org. Amanda, thank you so much for your time with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a wonderful time of year. I know it's cold outside, but it's an exciting way to get through the chilly weather.
And it'll get a little warmer, we're promised, and it'll get warmer with us giving too.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota, working with ND Dementia Care Services to offer programs like the Empowered Caregiver Series. Learn more at alz.org/MNND/education-programs.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 26th. In March of 1919, members of the American Expeditionary Force convened in Paris to create the American Legion, a patriotic veterans organization. World War I veterans returning home from Europe started posts across America. The first post in North Dakota was founded in Bismarck on May 20th, 1919. Post 1 was named after Private Lloyd Spetz, the first person from Bismarck to die in the war. From the beginning, music was an important and unifying force within the American Legion. Posts across the country formed drum and bugle corps. Drums and bugles gave direction and a beat to march to. They performed in their communities and competed against each other at the local, state, and national levels. The Lloyd Spetz Post No. 1 Drum and Bugle Corps was founded in 1928. In 1930, $5,000 was raised for uniforms, drums, and bugles. The 18-member corps wore white World War I metal helmets, green blouses, and red pants and black puttees, a strip of cloth wound around the lower leg, which was common in military attire back then. The Post 1 Drum and Bugle Corps proved to be popular, traveling across the state to perform and to compete against other drum and bugle corps. Post 1 was so impressive that in 1959, Governor John E. Davis designated them as the state's official corps and named them the Governors. Multiple governors over the years gave the Governors the same honor. On this date in 1978, the Bismarck Tribune devoted a half-page spread to the Governors' 50-year anniversary. By this point, they were North Dakota's most decorated drum and bugle corps, winning 22 state American Legion competitions. The Governors also traveled to 8 states and Canada and had competed at national American Legion conventions. In 1978, the Governors were still a very active group of 37, playing the latest hits, such as the Star Wars theme song. By this point, their uniform had simplified to blue pants and shirts. Interest in the corps waned in the 1980s, and the Governors played their last song at the 1989 State Centennial Celebration. As of 2020, the Jamestown Drum and Bugle Corps is the last one in the state. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Livewire, offering audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery services for conferences, meetings, and live events, serving the Prairie region and clients nationwide. More at livewirenow.com.
The killing of another person by federal agents in Minneapolis has sparked a new wave of protest in the city and across the U.S.
We're angry, but we won't give up hope. And above all else, we are clearly unified.
Now a judge considers the legality of President Trump's anti-immigration tactics in Minnesota. Our continuing coverage on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, travel writer Alicia Underly-Nelson shares smart tips for spring and summer travel, including what to know about trips to Canada and Europe during politically sensitive times. And we'll check back in with Williston Mayor Howard Klug on what Continental Resources drilling pause could mean for jobs, city revenues, and the future of the area. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.